plans do best. And he's coming with $2.5 million in NIH funding. So there are benefits to the state in approving this program as far as bringing federal dollars in to the state economy.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Senator Carter.
Dean, what is the length of the potential length of construction in the building?
Senator Hannan and Senator Carter, it's 18 months.
So 2000, deferring this to 2004 give you the opportunity, I mean deferring this, I saw you hitting it. Deferring the entrance of students until 2004 give you that 18-month period of time, or would could be anticipated that September 2003 would be the appropriate time to have the students?
Yes, with e-board approval today, we can admit students for 2003, which was the legislative intent.
So you did a precautionary thing in asking them for a one-year extension?
Senator Hanson and Carter, yes, that's correct.
And if you were to have this completed in 2003, would be the time to do this. Are you, or can you assure this body that you will have the potential of 36 students, and that would that cost, and the other researchers coming on board could maintain the day-to-day operations of the institution?
Senator Hannan and Senator Carter, I'm not quite sure. What's your question?
My question would be that if the legislature were to give you the $4 million plus the bonding piece that you're asking for, in 2003, will you have, number one, the student body to be able to take care of the expenses that you need? Number two, with the researchers that are coming on board and the dollars that they bring in terms of research, that you can maintain the day-to-day operations of the institution, of the veterinary school?
The student body, Senator Hannan and Senator Carter, would increase from 36 to 48 students.
Oh, okay.
With this program. And yes, we could admit them for the 2003 implementation of the program. The operating expenses or the operating monies would come from a budgetary note in the next legislative session, is my understanding. We would not be able to generate faculty salaries based on the indirect costs that come from federal grants, if that's your question.
That is my question. And would you be seeking an increase to accommodate that need?
Or not over what's already been legislated.
My concern, as we visited in Ashland, Dean, when you came down, is that I still strongly support the creation of the veterinary school to a four-year program. However, I'm having a difficult time right now with the consequences that we're faced with budget-wise. And it's a timeliness issue. It's not a matter of do we support veterinary medicine or don't we support veterinary medicine. There's some other requests here about higher education. So if we're just looking at economic development and creation of jobs in the construction industry, there are some other construction projects here that are going to be taking place. But where we're talking about using general fund monies and looking at a looming $500 to $600 million potential shortfall, it just places me in a difficult position of having to defer right now. And it bothers me that some of my colleagues who were not here during the 1980s, when we did go through this, we cut not once, not twice, not three, but we had four special sessions because we lacked the will to cut enough money the first time. We lacked the will to cut it enough the second time. We lacked the will to cut it the third time. And by the fourth time, access makes perfect. And I don't care to repeat that. I don't care to repeat a performance of giving false hope and false promises to people and then reneging on that and cutting back. I were to grant this today, and we were in a special session in January, and cut this out, you would feel totally betrayed. But if we could defer this until we get a better handle on what's going on here, I think it's a more appropriate approach to the dilemma that we're faced with. And for that reason, Dean, it's not that I diminish my respect for you, OSU, or the program of veterinary medicine. I support all of them. But it's a timeliness issue. And I must support deferring at this time. Is there further discussion or questions? Representative Doyle?
Thank you. The concern that I have is, especially as we look in context of the other projects that we are going to be reviewing today, and we see that, you know, as long as it's not general fund dollars, we don't mind spending the money to help improve the economy. Probably more than anything else, our focus has to be on what can be done to stimulate this economy. And I look at a $4 million investment of the general fund to do that as that an investment. It's something that is positive, something that, you know, we can show is going to not only impact in the construction industry, but, you know, just the idea that we're spending $4 million to send students to Washington State, when instead we can bring that revenue back here into town, into Oregon. And seeing that, you know, there's already people on board to come on with this kind of project, where we're going to see some additional dollars invested in the state, you know, I'm just concerned that we're choosing to take a track of protecting the dollars we have, as opposed to investing those dollars for future growth and make sure that we get out of this recession as soon as possible. Instead, just by looking at where we can cut budgets without any kind of view towards economic stimulus, to me is a concern. And on top of that, when these other construction projects are being given approval, it seems to me that that we are being contradictory and making saying a position that as long as it's basically other people's money, we don't mind spending it. But when it comes to our own investment opportunity, we're just going to basically keep the money in our pocket and wait for another day. I think, you know, by deferring it this time around means that it will be unlikely that the students would be here in 2003, but then we're having to wait another year. And at minimum of a year, and it may be longer based on this reasoning. And you know, we may not see this project until we see the economy starting to come back. And I think, again, that's just a short-sighted view that instead we ought to be looking more to how we can help stimulate our economy. And this is a good project, I think, that we should do that.
Representative, I appreciate your comments, but if you're unwilling to cut $4 million today, I really worry about the future where you have to cut $500 million. Peanuts or peanut butter? You can cut it any way you want, and you can say, I'm going to cut somebody else's program, unless you're prepared to stand up here and say 65% of the budget is K-12, and you're going to cut $500 million out of K-12, I don't think there's a breathing heart in this building that's prepared to bite that bullet. And yet you want to cut everybody else's budget somewhere, somehow, to invest. I agree with economic stimulation, but you also have to bear in mind is what is the market willing to bear? And right now, you got a market that says you're short potentially $500 million. And $4 million is small potatoes. But if you can't come to grips with dealing with $4 million, I don't know how we're going to come to grips with dealing with $500 million when the pressure really gets on to say, we've got to make some tough cuts. I was here during the 1980s, mm-hmm. and there was blood on this floor. There was blood all over this building. From constituents, special interest groups, and everybody else. And unless you're willing to start saying that I'm going to cut K through 12, $500 million today, I think we're trying to fool ourselves, and this is a manana theory. The problem exists, but it's tomorrow. It isn't today. Well, it's today. It began September 11th. It began before September 11th. It began during this session. And we were trying to create an atmosphere of doing things. And we knew that we might potentially be back in this position. Co-chair Westland and I sat in the co-chair's room back there and told Representative Schrader, you realize this may be postponed. You realize that we want to proceed with this, but we may have to slow down the train a little bit. There's a whole bunch of things here. There's a whole bunch of things that I'd love to build. I got a $15 million appropriation that I'm having to forego for my university in my area that could provide one hell of a construction job for us in Jackson County. But why? Because we don't have $15 million in the next biennium. We're short $500 million in this biennium. So, I don't know. I think it's time to have a reality check here. And it's not my diminished respect or regard for jobs, the economy, or anything else. But it's a fact of priority. You got X amount of dollars to deal with. And unless you're prepared to stand up and start cutting the hell out of K through 12, it isn't going to happen.
I know a win-win suggestion. I have win-win.
Senator Carter?
I will support the deferral and bring it back up on January's calendar to where we are at that time.
I don't know if we have an e-board in January because of potential special session.
Everything's
in play, huh?
Yeah, man. Everything's in play, then, regardless.
So, for the next
people,
all things considered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
I am, you know, I'm hopeful in terms of maybe take the, you know, if this is deferred, come back in January and explore other ways in terms of it's not general fund dollars. In terms of, you know, I appreciate what Representative Doyle is that we've got to get projects going forward, but I, you know, the glaring thing on this is the general fund in my mind. You know, and if we can reduce that through foundations going out and seeking grants or something from someone else to help pay that portion of it, the industry itself coming forward. I mean, when you look at, I mean, I'm not expecting that they'll be able to bear, you know, the entire cost in terms of, you know, but when you have, you know, engineering, which obviously they have more money in that community and that constituency, but I mean, they came and they said, you know, we'll put up $25 million to match, you know, some bonds going forward. Now, that's where I'm looking at in terms of saying, how can we do this, and is there an opportunity? I have no idea. Is there an opportunity to look to figure how you can reduce the general fund dollars going forward because I think we've got to do something going forward with the program. You can't let the program die. It isn't practical to go forward into the future with this split Washington-Oregon, but the reality is, you know, if it's $500 million and the choice placed in front of me is, do I put little old ladies out on the street or build a building, you know, with that $4 million, I'm going to, you know, keep the little old ladies housed. That, and I'm looking at having to throw little old ladies out on the street, you know, in a special session. That's where I'm, you know, that's where I'm at this point in time. So I'm hoping in terms of defer, is there an opportunity to explore other options to see, is there any way to reduce the general fund obligation to match that you can go forward those dollars?
Mr. Bender, on the motion to defer, on your request or your recommendation, was it to a certain time?
No, Mr. Chair, it was not. It was until the state's budget shortfall is known and addressed. I would like to point out, if I may, to the subcommittee that I've distributed a revised letter from Higher Ed for this request, where the board has delayed implementation, is requesting implementation with a delay of 1 year from the letter that you may have seen. Because of that, a decision to fund this project could be delayed to as late as April of next year without having any effect on the implementation schedule as it is outlined. Therefore, LFO, given the budget situation, is recommending a delay until the state's budget shortfall is known and addressed. Presumably, actions will be taken before April. Note, however, that that is sort of the deadline for getting this project implemented as it is now scheduled to be implemented. If it's not, so the decision to fund this is not made by April of 2002, it would have to be further delayed or abandoned.
Is this a board decision to delay for a year?
Mr. Chairman?
Just to clarify,
just a moment, Representative Alfie.
Just to clarify, the implementation start date in this letter is 2004, where Dean is talking about implementation start date 2003. Is that correct?
The implementation of accepting new students would be 2004. The project would have to start construction of the project in the spring of next year in order to allow it to be completed in time to accommodate those additional students. But since the construction does not have to be started until spring, a decision could be delayed until spring, basically until April, without delaying the current implementation schedule.
To implement 2004.
And that's what my motion was.
Mr. Kenneth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're saying the same thing. The use of the building has been delayed from 2003 to 2004. The dean will admit the students in 2003 as freshmen. When they reach that part of the curriculum that they would have in 2004 go up to Pullman, the building will have been constructed, faculty would have been hired, facilities would have been outfitted, and they would then commence the curriculum at that time. Is that not correct, Dean?
Yes, okay.
The university system will, of course, on a resident subcommittee, but we would ask that the motion would be specific to a time, because after April, any delay beyond that would be detrimental to the program. And I have to underscore that, and would put our relationship with WSU and the ability to go forward in jeopardy. Understand that the special session may give us all a different outcome, understand that, but an affirmative decision must be made, or a negative decision must be made, in order to either begin unwinding this program or making it go forward. So we could live with the later than the motion that Senator Carter made, but we do need a definitive answer.
Okay. Senator Carter now moves that we adopt a delay with a date
of April. No later than April of 2002.
Right.
Dean, is that acceptable?
Yes, sir.
Yes?
That means, Dean, you can't go anywhere.
Senator Carter's motion is to defer action on the request until no later than April 2002. That would indicate that a decision would have to be rendered if it was February or March. Decision was made to proceed. It would be made.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify.
Representative Hill.
So the university could come back any time between now and then when they felt appropriate if they've got some other information so they feel that they can go forward.
And or, for the record, that there is clarification in terms of the state's budget, since the state had made arrangements with OSU Veterinary School of Veterinary Science. Thank you.
Okay. You've heard the motion. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Not. It's been so approved. Okay. Let's get back on our agenda here if we can jump around here. Item 63, community colleges, and then we'll move next to higher education and complete the agenda. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Cam Price Brawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. You have a request in front of you that would ask for what I would call a special authority for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to apply for national emergency grants from the Department of Labor. And through what I would call a modified emergency board process. The basis of this request is that we feel we need the quickest possible turnaround when applying for a national emergency grant. These are grants that have no filing deadlines. Currently, the President's economic stimulus package has an additional $3 billion set aside for national emergency and funds for dislocated workers. We would like the opportunity to attach ourselves to those resources as quickly as dislocations happen in this state. By using a streamlined process, we do feel that we would be able to access those federal funds and meet the needs of workers who are facing layoff in this state. And I could go on and okay. Give you the numbers and all of that, but given your time, I'll...
Thank you. Questions? Not DAS?
We recommend you approve the request.
Okay. LFO?
LFO also recommends approval.
LFO recommends approval of authorization to apply for national emergency grants from the U.S. Department of Labor as need arises to assist dislocated workers. Representative Hill.
Just so I understand, this will necessitate you coming in if you receive the grants, getting limitation increase, so you will be back reporting to us each time you get these, or is this the last time we'll see you?
No. They'll be back to receive expenditure limitation once they receive the grant.
Thank you.
Okay. Carte blanche authority.
You guys just want to hear my speech anyway.
It says here at the time the department will request appropriate expenditure limitation changes and will include an impact of any national emergency awards. Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair, members, we are anticipating the department coming back one time in the spring for an emergency expenditure limitation adjustment for grants that it has received.
It may potentially be possible that they will have to come back again, even during the next legislative session, if they get subsequent grants as well.
So they will occur. Okay? No further discussion. Is there objection? Not, and so approved. Thank you. Senator Carter?
All right, Mr. Chairman.
Item 64, Department of Higher Education. Eastern Oregon University Integrated Services Building.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that I've reformed. I am for this, and I think that this is an innovative approach in terms of how to build a building in the university system.
This item was before our subcommittee. The two representatives, Doyle and Johnson, we discussed it quite lengthy. Adult and Family Services, or DHS, is going to rent some floor space from this building, and the building will be paid for with rent fees generated from building the building on campus, renting it to a state agency and recovering those monies to pay for the bonded indebtedness. These are Article 11F bonds. These are fee bonds. And we postponed it, and it's back before us. And no need to explain it any further. It's been here. We've done that already.
Representative Hills had a religious experience.
He became a convert. Das.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, we recommend approval of the request.
Telephone.
We also recommend approval of the request.
You've heard the recommendation, and the chair would move the approval of the request. And establish $4.3 million out of funds capital construction, Article 11F 1 bonds, expenditure limitation for the construction of the Integrated Services Building, Eastern Oregon University. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? If not, it is ordered. Representative Hill, because you've had this great conversion, you will be able to carry the bill.
I'd be more than happy to.
Item 65, OSU Engineering Building. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Hannon, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Bob Simonson, Director of Capital Construction and Planning for the Oregon University System. Before we begin with OSU's project, I'd like to take a minute to discuss the Article 11G projects and how they're funded in an appropriate context. Given the current economic uncertainties, it may appear that we're a little too ambitious in our plans. And however, I want to address several key factors in our decision to support these projects. They are enrollment growth, the impact of additional debt service to the state, and three, the economic benefits to the state economy. The OUS enrollment is at the highest in our history, with almost 74,000 students, and is projected to grow steadily due to the increase in college-age population as a result of the echo effect of the baby boom generation. In other words, the children of the post-World War II baby boom are now entering college. And in response to the original baby boomers, the OUS institutions, as well as colleges and universities across the nation, expanded their facilities in the late 60s and early 70s to meet this unprecedented growth in enrollment. Much of this construction was financed with Article 11G bonds, which are now being retired some 30 years later, which brings me to a second point of additional debt service. The retirement of this existing debt, approval of the projects before you, will only require an additional $700,000 in general fund support by the 2000.
call to order the Natural Resource Subcommittee meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and apologize for my tardiness. Mr. Rocco has some material that he wants to present to us first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the department has responded to questions from yesterday, and that material has been provided to you. You can, if the agency may want to refer to some of that when they get started, but the questions from yesterday have been answered in a memo with some attachments to it that everyone has received. And that's all I have to say, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, at this time, let's bring forward Stephanie Howick and Andy Ginsberg, and if you could step us through this material that you presented to us, that would be
okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stephanie Howick, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me today is Helen Lockridge, the Administrator of the Management Services Division, and Andy Ginsberg, the Administrator of the Air Quality Division. The packet that Pam just handed out is includes information about the Oregon benchmark. We are actually going to go through the Oregon benchmarks in detail with each program, and for example, we're doing air today, and we'll have handouts that will pertain to that. Also, Ken had asked for a consent decree copy having to do with the Willamette CMDLs. That's in the packet. Representative Hayden had requested some information on the Lapine groundwater project. There attached is an overhead presentation at the end of the packet that walks through the whole demonstration project. We have attached a summary of the work that was done with regard to the enforcement grant that Representative Hayden asked about. Also, we don't have any information attached on the diversity coordinator, but there's a paragraph at the end of my memo that explains how work was redirected in my office to establish that position in human resources. And the last item on the memo is just a paragraph with regard to the issue of unfunded mandates and my confirmation in checking with the program that we always are mindful of Measure 30 and that we, in our interpretation of what it means and the work that we do not place unfunded mandates in terms of new program requirements. That said, I think there are questions that come up, notably from municipalities, for example, some of the new federal underground injection control requirements, stormwater requirements, where they might raise a question about that, and they have, in fact, had dialogue with us. And what I would like to do, if you want further discussion about this, I'm not a lawyer, and this is not my area of expertise, but I would be happy to have one of our Department of Justice natural resource attorneys who advises us on our rules and issues like this come and speak to the committee on this matter in more detail if you'd like that. Questions or comments from the committee members? I'm sure that as people work through this material, if they have further questions, they'll be doing so much. That's just fine.
Madam Chair, I wanted to express my appreciation for the work that was done to return this information so rapidly. I noticed that when the administrator handed it to me, it was still warm. That's that word.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, there is an unsung hero as to why that is still warm, working feverishly at the copy machine.
So we appreciate that. So thank you very much. Let's proceed with the presentation on the air quality division. And once again, committee, please feel very free to ask questions as they arise.
Madam Chair, again, just to refresh your memory, we are at tab 4 in the binder, and tab 4 has three sections. The first part is the program overview. The second is the budget overview for air quality, and then third is some supplemental information that I'm not planning on covering in my presentation, but I'll just point you to it when we get to that part.
Okay, the air quality program, as I had mentioned in my agency overview, we're very pleased that today 100% of Oregonians live in areas where the air meets national health standards. As I indicated on this slide, in 1980, only 30% of Oregonians enjoyed clean air, so we have made progress. The air quality priorities, as you see in your packet, are pollution from area and mobile sources and regulation of that pollution, and the analogous term that you often hear in water quality is non-point sources. It's the same concept, area-wide and mobile sources. Elimination, emphasizing or elimination of toxics from hazardous air pollution, and there has been a process that we've been through with an advisory committee on that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then we want to continue our successes in controlling pollution from industrial sources. And the program basically has four components that they use to do the work that they do. One is called statewide implementation planning to stay in attainment with air quality standards. And that is just what it says. It's a massive planning process and it's multifaceted. Secondly, as I said, there's a focus on developing a program for air toxics specifically, which is an emerging important issue. Third, our program does ambient air quality monitoring assisted by our laboratory. And fourth, of course, we have our regulatory programs where we control the point sources, the area, and the mobile sources through a regulatory process. Performance measures, and I think, Andy, if we have the handout, I will give us that at this time. We have Oregon Benchmark. Oh, can you go to, oh, no, that's right. Oregon Benchmark. Percent of time that the air is healthy to breathe for all Oregonians, and percent of permits issued in a target time frame or less. There are also some other performance measures shown on your sheet there, and I asked Andy to bring the information that Representative Morgan had asked for, and if you would like to get into that in some detail now, I could have Andy walk through it with you. That would be just fine. So it would be great.
One question, Chair. Seems you have definitely got your slide up showing 30% of Oregon enjoyed clean air, so 70% didn't. What were the sources that we were able to clean up in 20 years that contributed that much?
Andy can correct me if I'm wrong, but we began our industrial regulatory permitting program in 1972, and you will see on page 34, you can see. Starting in, we only went back to 1990, but you can see the number of permits that were issued over time. And we attribute a lot of the cleanup in the air quality to the regulation of our industrial point sources. We've also, as you know, implemented a vehicle inspection program, 1975. So a lot of these efforts started in the early 70s, and that contributed a lot to cleaning up the air quality. There have been increasing efforts in particulate matter that reduce the wood stove smoke, the flash burning smoke, open burning. The EPA had did have a standard of PM10, and it's now tightened down to a standard of PM2.5, so we're getting further controls in those areas. So it's been really a combination.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And if I could draw your attention to the handout, there are two benchmarks from the Oregon Progress Board that relate to air quality. The top one, under the environment category, has to do with the percentage of time that Oregonians breathe clean air. And you can see that I've provided the data from 1990, and then it's also projected out into the future. But I want to first start by just going back a little bit in time and let you know that in the late 70s, we were violating federal air quality standards regularly. For example, in 1978, we exceeded the ozone standard 23 times, the carbon monoxide standard 294 times, and the PM10 standard 23 times. So we used to have very significant air quality problems, and as you can see on this table, we are close to 100%. We're now at 100%, although we bounce in and out a little bit year to year. And I just wanted to give you a little background on why that happened. First of all, this chart is looking at how many times we exceed the federal air quality standards. And exceed means whenever our monitors measure air quality that's higher than the standard. But that's not equal to a violation. Not to get complicated about it, a violation, you have to exceed several times, and there's a formula that EPA uses to determine if you violate. Violations are a much more serious matter because they, with them come federal sanctions, and all kinds of regulatory requirements kick in. But the progress board actually measures exceedances, and that's what's important because the standards are based, are designed to protect public health. If you look at 1998, you'll see that we had 99.75% of Oregonians breathing clean air. That year we had some exceedances of the ozone standard in Portland. Ozone is a pollutant that depends not only on the emission levels, but also on how hot and how sunny it is. It's a chemical reaction in the atmosphere. We had a very hot summer in 1998. We had some exceedances of the ozone standard. In fact, we violated the ozone standard in 1998. In 1999, we got a lot closer. That was actually a carbon monoxide exceedance in Medford. And just to show you how sensitive the carbon monoxide standard is to motor vehicle emissions, the cause of that exceedance was a vintage car parade that went down the street in Medford right past our monitor. And we've been working with the community to try and reroute that parade so that doesn't happen again in the future.
Reroute the parade, yeah.
Then in 2000, we had another carbon monoxide exceedance in Medford. This time it was from construction at the business right next to where our monitor is, and they had a little diesel generator that was operating right near the monitor. So, as you can see, we're right on the edge here, and when we look forward to the future, our challenges are that we have tremendous population growth, and Director Hallett's going to be talking about that later, but the population growth does threaten to cause us to go back into non-attainment or to have exceedances in the future, and we need to keep working to prevent that. Also, we have the new standards that Director Hallett will talk about. EPA tightened down the standards for ozone, and in particular, the ozone standard changed from being a one-hour standard to an eight-hour standard. It became more stringent, and for us, that raises some concerns again for Medford because Medford is a very sunny, hot place, and it's got, because of the mountain ball there, the air can be trapped there, and we are a little concerned about ozone under the new standard in Medford. We actually have had five exceedances of the eight-hour ozone standard since 1998 in Medford. That's not enough to create a violation by a long shot, but it's something that we're tracking. And then we'll have the new PM2.5 standard, which has to do with wood smoke and other types of burning activities, which we're monitoring for and concerned about. So that's all I had to say at this point about the environment indicator, unless there are questions.
Madam Chair. In 1955, I was an air quality technician at the University of California Riverside campus studying smog and ozone. And I'm just wondering what the cost-benefit ratio of all the studies that's been done in that 50 years. Are we saving tons of lives by our 99.99% success rate here? What, you know, with the billions of dollars we spend on it, is mortality and morbidity markedly down because of that? Is quality of life markedly improved? How do we know if we're spending the money wisely?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the answer to that question is yes. We have, and the way we know is the studies that EPA conducts when they reevaluate the ambient air quality standards. They're required periodically to review the standards. That's why they change the ozone standard and the particulate standard. And in that analysis, they always evaluate the costs and benefits, and in particular, the benefits from reduced mortality or morbidity and reduced hospital admissions for asthma, reduced lost work days, and things like that. So the data are very strongly indicate that these programs are cost effective. And then on the flip side of that, when we implement the program, as Director Hallett mentioned, through the state implementation plan, EPA tells us what the standard is that we have to meet, but they don't tell us exactly what we need to do to meet it. They leave that somewhat up to the states and the local communities that are affected. And cost benefit is taken into account at that point when we decide which types of control strategies we'll use. The vehicle inspection program is a good example of a highly cost-effective strategy. It doesn't cost that much per ton of pollution reduced, and as well as a number of our industrial emission control strategies and so forth. So our focus is always on cost effectiveness.
Madam Chair, my question relative to the emissions testing and cost effectiveness.
So far.
We've got some real good studies and some evidence and some practical models from Colorado that show that a lot of the air pollution control monitoring can be done with remote viewing locations and mechanisms, including notification of errors. And the way this is accomplished, colleagues, is that at a place where traffic decelerates to a corner, or decelerates to an off-ramp, they slow, an infrared camera is focused on that deceleration area. Emissions can be tracked and mapped with imaging. And the license plate of the vehicles that is clearly visible. And then those that fail the quick emissions test are the ones that have been referred to the emissions testing center. And over time, by choosing locations carefully, virtually every vehicle within a given airship can be looked at without an intrusive requirement for an annual sticker. And it's, you know, it's like everything else, 10% of the vehicles produce 90% of locations. This is a way to identify the 10% and focus your enforcement efforts on them rather than having the 100% get a sticker every year, or every 5 years, or whatever it is. So I'm just wondering, what is the plan for introducing this technology into Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, we have already begun experimenting with the remote sensing technology. We got a grant from EPA to bring in the technology into Oregon, and we ran it in a number of cities, including Bend and Portland, and I can't remember the other cities, but we ran it in a number of cities on a voluntary basis. We worked with the media to let everyone know where these remote sensing units were set up. They were primarily in the parking lots of our shopping mall. And we asked people to voluntarily come through, and we screened them. We tested the technology, and we found that actually the technology is very good at identifying clean vehicles. It's not very good at identifying dirty vehicles. And by that I mean it's not accurate enough because it's just sending a laser beam from a distance to tell you how whether a dirty car is above the standard or below. But the very clean cars, the ones that really don't need to be tested separately, can identify those. And so now we are in the process of ordering some of those units to further evaluate them. We're working with the motor vehicle dealers to actually equip some vans with remote sensing equipment so that we can take our tests to their location, so they don't have to send their employees to drive their used vehicles to our location. And through that work, we will further determine the effectiveness of the equipment and the cost and so forth. And our plan is to continue on, probably in between screening on an area-wide basis in Portland and Medford.
Madam Chairman, in the last legislative session, we moved in that direction to allow auto dealers to get certification for brand new automobiles, which previously had to go get a sticker. Now they're new from the factory, they haven't been around at all, and obviously they're going to meet the emission standards. I think that's helpful. But we need to take more steps so that we're less intrusive with the requirement to have people go physically to a location and get a certification sticker.
I agree. Well, in our discussions also, you mentioned that I believe something about the technology actually in the cars themselves changing somewhat that made them easier to tell.
And Chair, that's correct. The cars that were built since 1996 are equipped with a technology called onboard diagnostics. We call it OBD. And it's a computer system that keeps track of the emission control equipment that's on the vehicle. So instead of testing the tailpipes and checking what the emissions are, we can now plug into the computer system on the car, and it will give us a printout that tells us which components are working and aren't working. It's much quicker. The next generation of onboard diagnostics, we're hoping, will actually allow a remote test to be done, where a vehicle owner could drive by a radio sensor, press a button, and it would transmit their data, and they wouldn't even have to come through the cap. That's not available yet, but we are working on some committees with EPA to see if we can get that in the future. So the technology is rapidly changing in vehicle inspection, and we're keeping up with it.
Do you have a timeline to actually implement the drive-by technology?
For the remote sensing?
Yes.
Not yet. We're still experimenting with equipment. It's been evolving quickly, and the actual technology has changed just recently to become more accurate. So we're projecting that we'll be able to phase it in over the next several biennia, but we don't have a specific timeline yet.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just be sure we're on track with your needs. Would you like Andy to walk through in the same kind of detail the economic performance measure on your handout?
Let's get that one over with while we're on the performance benchmark.
Okay. Our second measure from the progress board has to do with timeliness of permit issuance. And as you can see, we're not as close to the 100% mark there as we are on the air quality standards. Back in the early 90s, you can see numbers around 57%. What was going on in early 1990 is that Congress reauthorized the Clean Air Act, actually in 1990, and as part of that, they added Title V to the Clean Air Act, which is a new industrial permitting program. And we already had an existing permitting program that was called the Air Contaminant Discharge Permit Program that has been in existence since the early 70s. In early 1991, we had to begin developing the Title V program, and we didn't yet have any funding to work on that. So basically what we did was slow down on the air contaminant discharge permit work so we could begin developing the Title V program. As we got into about 1993, the legislature did provide us with some interim funding to develop the Title V program. And by 1994, the program was approved by EPA, and we began issuing Title V permits. And you can see as we had separate resources to work on Title V, we began digging out from the Air Contaminant Discharge Permit Program to the point where by 1996 we were hitting a 73% timeliness mark. Then you see an interesting drop in 1997 down to 50%. That is actually a positive number, even though it looks negative, and the reason is that we decided that we needed to completely eliminate the backlog in air quality. And we redoubled our efforts, and we removed all of the old permits. The way the progress score calculates their benchmark, that gave us a low number because we issued a lot of permits that had been sitting around for a long time. So it looks like a drop. It actually was an improvement. And you can see that today we're at about 73%, and we're projecting to get close to 100%. One of the other things that changed here is that up until last year, the progress board was measuring timeliness as a permit issued within 120 days from when we received the application. Now, we have all different types of permits. We have some that are simple renewals. We have some that are simple modifications. And then we have complex new facilities. We have complex modifications, and they all take a different amount of time. So we have come up with very specific metrics for each type of permit action. And we will now be measuring our activities against those. So the number will look the same in the end, but the calculation beneath it will be much more sophisticated. And then, as we move into the future, we will be implementing a number of streamlining changes in the air quality program, which we'll be talking about a little later. And we're tightening up our targets, so there'll be more stringent targets for ourselves in the future to keep up with that. So we're raising the bar. We'll be issuing permits faster, but we'll be lowering the target level so that it will be harder for us to meet them. And we're hoping to be able to meet those more tight levels in the future.
I think that the performance standards that relate to the time frames that you're supposed to operate in, and those kinds of things that relate more to customer satisfaction, are going to be useful tools for the